Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sheila Carapico, professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, who discusses the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia and the kingdom's links to terrorism. Former NASA climate scientist James Hansen, who explains why he advocates a carbon fee and dividend system to reduce the burning of fossil fuels. And Antonia Yuhas, an energy analyst, author, and investigative reporter, who reflects on the sixth anniversary of the BP Gulf oil spill disaster, assessing the economic and environmental damage and a significant change in public opinion. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For the first time, the United States military dropped more bombs and launched more missiles from drones in Afghanistan than with conventional aircraft last year. NATO officially ended military operations in Afghanistan in 2014, but some 9,800 U.S. troops remain in the South Asian nation. In 2015, drones dropped 53% of all bombs and missiles in Afghanistan, lower in tonnage than 2014, but the number of drone missions doubled since the surge of NATO forces when over 100,000 U.S. troops were deployed in Afghanistan. America's drone war in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Yemen is a covert operation, and little information is available about civilian victims of drone strikes. The Guardian newspaper interviewed 8 family members of drone strike victims in Pakistan and Yemen. Families are struggling to recover and receive compensation for injuries. The Obama White House has promised to release an official tally of drone deaths, but victims' families have low expectations and are not expecting any apologies. Rafiq Or Rehman, whose grandmother and father were killed in a drone attack in tribal Pakistan, observed, "If America kills any Westerner, they apologize and compensate. But if it's Pakistanis like us, they don't care." 3 years ago, Egyptian tech entrepreneur Omar Gaber was getting ready to travel to Silicon Valley to make a presentation about his new software company, Instabug. At the time, Egyptians were pouring into the streets to demand the resignation of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi, who days later was toppled in a military coup. Unable to get a visa to travel to California, Gaber watched his presentation on Twitter, made on his behalf by a friend. Today, Instabug is a hit, used on 100 million mobile devices. Despite years of upheaval, a struggling economy, and increasing repression under President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, Egypt's startup sector is thriving. For some young entrepreneurs, creating a business is a way to work toward a positive future when avenues of political change appear closed. Some consider their work in Egypt as a form of resistance against a corrupt and authoritarian system. Ahmed Zahran, co-founder of a company that produces solar-powered irrigation and pumping systems, says, "The same problem that we had with former President Mubarak is a problem that we have with business as well, because there are tens and tens of Mubaraks and Sisis in business, and we are trying to topple them by creating business models that are more resilient, that do not depend on bribes and being close to government and kickbacks." 1 year after Freddie Gray died in the custody of the Baltimore police, city resident Sean Young was arrested for interfering with police officers. A year earlier, Young was a high-profile protester who was seen grabbing a CNN reporter's microphone and cussing out the news network on live TV in the violent aftermath of Gray's death in inner-city Baltimore. To Young, many of the circumstances that spurred the riot are much the same as when Gray died on April 19, 2015. Gray's arrest for an alleged illegal switchblade and his death resulting from injuries sustained while in a police paddy wagon a week later spurred escalating protests that cast an international spotlight on police and race relations in Baltimore. The neighborhood that Freddie Gray lived in was rife with abandoned apartments, sky-high unemployment, and drug abuse. Housing advocates across Baltimore are pushing for a $40 million fund to transform entire neighborhoods with affordable housing run by community land trusts. At present, tens of thousands of Baltimore residents remain at risk for homelessness and lack access to good jobs. Todd Shirkus of the Community Labor Alliance United Workers explained, "When you leave it up to the market to solve the housing, it's a failure. The other way to do this is for the public to invest to correct speculative pressures, which would create a lot of jobs." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
President Obama concluded a visit to Saudi Arabia last week to meet with King Salman and other Gulf Cooperation Council leaders amid much speculation about a falling out between Washington and Riyadh. Friction between the oil-rich kingdom and the Obama administration has risen over a number of issues, including the U.S.-brokered nuclear agreement with Iran and, more recently, proposed congressional legislation that would expose the Saudi government to legal jeopardy from lawsuits related to the September 11, 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. Saudi Arabia's warning it will sell off $750 billion in U.S. bonds and other American assets if the U.S. Congress passes a bipartisan bill that would allow victims of 9/11 and other terrorist attacks to sue foreign governments. The Obama administration has, in turn, applied heavy pressure on Congress to block the bill. Separately, several members of the House and Senate, joining with families of 9/11 victims, are pushing for the declassification of 28 pages of a congressional report on the 2001 al-Qaeda attack that may shed light on a possible Saudi role in the worst terrorist attack in U.S. history. Human rights organizations cite a long history of abuses perpetrated by the Saudi government, including the arrest and imprisonment of dozens of dissidents and human rights defenders, systematic discrimination against women and religious minorities, and the beheading, crucifixion, and public flogging of individuals for nonviolent crimes. The Saudis have also been criticized for their U.S.-backed military intervention in Yemen, where indiscriminate bombing has killed large numbers of civilians. Your reporter spoke with Sheila Carapico, professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, Virginia, who discusses the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia and the links between the monarchy's promotion of the Wahhabist interpretation of Islam and extremist religious groups and terrorism.
This was President Obama's fourth visit to Saudi Arabia as president, and it's primarily based on a commercial relationship where the United States sells a lot of weapons to Saudi Arabia. Oil is pivotal, but so are arms sales, and so have relations based on common enmity. So the United States was opposed to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, obviously, and also to the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And in the meantime, it has become a relationship based on American arms sales to Saudi Arabia.
Despite Saudi Arabia's horrendous human rights record and violations that include the beheadings, torture, whippings, discrimination against the female population of Saudi Arabia, U.S.-Saudi relationship has been buttressed by a real expensive lobbying machine the Saudis employ, and from my understanding, lavish gifts over the years to U.S. politicians and presidents, including gifts to presidential libraries and institutions like the Clinton Foundation. Do you want to comment on how else there's a bond between Washington and Riyadh?
Yeah, the Saudis employ very smart people. So currently there's a huge veritable industry in Washington or around Washington, inside the Beltway and beyond the Beltway, of Saudi-funded lobbyists and PR firms, that churn out a kind of improbable and yet well-funded narrative about of happy news from the kingdom. And the Obama administration, unfortunately, has appreciated that because it is an arms-selling industry that boosts American exports of arms to Saudi Arabia. And therefore, we as a nation benefit from a relationship with the government, which is horrible, but where we benefit from selling arms.
One of the more important questions surrounding the U.S. relationship with the Saudis, Professor, is the promotion of the Wahhabist interpretation of Islam that many Americans are not aware of. But I wonder, as we talk about Saudi Arabia and its links to extremism, if you would discuss briefly for us what Wahhabi Islam is and what are the links, if any, to terrorist activity in the Middle East and across the world?
Oh, I mean, that's such a deep and important question that you just asked. Going back to 1979, and I know for a lot of your listeners that sounds like ancient history, but there were two things that happened that year. One was the Islamic Revolution in Iran, and the other one was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And at the time, Saudi Arabia decided to export a Salafi fundamentalist Wahhabi version of Islam against both the Islamic Revolution in Iran and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And the United States was, I mean, completely in support of the Saudi export of Wahhabism or Salafism or this sort of very fundamentalist, intolerant version of Islam, which hadn't actually been very well known or widely disseminated before then. So now in 2016, the United States has decided that they don't really particularly like this Saudi-led or Saudi-inspired Salafist or Wahhabist version of Islam. But during the period of being anti-Soviet and anti-the Iranian Islamic Revolution, the United States was very appreciative of a version of Islam which would be anti-Shia and anti-Soviet. So the Saudis, I mean, are clearly complicit or responsible for the genesis of a fundamentalist and Salafist version of Islam. But on the other hand, the United States has also been very much supportive of the Saudi monarchy. And again, this comes back to Saudi purchases of American weapons and support of American strategic objectives in Afghanistan and in the Gulf and in Yemen.
That was Sheila Carapico, professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, Virginia. For more views on the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Former NASA climate scientist James Hansen is one of the world's leading authorities on climate change. He testified before Congress back in 1988 that global warming was already occurring due to the burning of fossil fuels, becoming one of the first scientists to go on the record with that assertion. Hansen now works at Columbia University's Earth Institute, where he continues to do research and publish groundbreaking papers on climate change. But he's also an advocate for the need to take action. He's been arrested several times in civil disobedience actions in opposition to mountaintop removal coal mining and the now-dead Keystone XL pipeline. Dr. Hansen has promoted placing a price on carbon through a fee and dividend approach, in which everyone would pay higher prices for fossil fuels, but all legal U.S. residents would share equally in a rebate thereby rewarding those who can serve. He thinks the other method of pricing carbon, through a cap-and-trade system, is a gimmick that wouldn't achieve its expressed goal. Hansen visited Yale University in early April as the Yale Climate Change and Health Initiative's climate change leader in residence. What follows are excerpts from his April 8th conversation with Dr. Robert Dubrow, professor of epidemiology and faculty director of the initiative at Yale School of Public Health.
As long as fossil fuels are allowed to be the cheapest energy, then they're going to continue to be burned. I don't care what agreements you have in Paris or any place else. They're just scraps of paper. If fossil fuels appear to the consumer to be the cheapest energy, they'll keep burning them. The problem is that they're not really the cheapest to society. They do not include their cost to society. The human health effects of air pollution and water pollution from fossil fuels and the climate effects are not included. And so the way to allow clean energies and energy efficiency to compete most effectively with fossil fuels is to put a rising fee on fossil fuels that you would collect from the fossil fuel company at the domestic mine or port of entry. And of course the fossil fuel companies will add that to the price of the fuel. So it's going to make the fossil fuels more expensive, but it'll just make their price more honest. An economy is more effective if the prices are honest and reflect their true costs. So it actually will be economically beneficial to do that. You know, if you simply make energy more expensive, that depresses the economy. However, if the money that's collected is put back into the economy by giving it to the public, an equal amount to all legal residents, then it actually spurs the economy because it's somewhat progressive tax. Poor people have a smaller carbon footprint than rich people. So there will be a moderate impact on the inequality of wealth. But the main purpose is to provide the right incentives. The person who does better than average in limiting their fossil fuel use will make money, will come out ahead. But if they want to stay on the positive side of the ledger, they're going to have to pay attention to their purchases. Won't even have to think about many of them. I mean, some of them will be obvious, like the efficiency of the vehicle you drive, but others will just show up on the price of things on the shelf. Food that's imported from New Zealand, which we do import now, will become relatively more expensive than food from the nearby farm. But you have to do this gradually. You can't suddenly make fossil fuels much more expensive. So you do it with this gradually rising fee. And this is the only way. The reason this is crucial is because this is the only way you can make it international, that you can make it global. The world is not doing this. And none of the policies in the United States or Europe or the different states, they're all trying to screwy cap and trade with offsets because it allows lots of finagling. It allows you to give favors to this lobbyist or that one. You would have to ask each of 190 countries to have a cap. Well, that's what they're trying to do. You know, they're encouraging, tell us what your cap is going to be. It doesn't matter what they say. As long as fossil fuels are cheapest, they're going to keep burning them. And so you can't do it with caps. What is a cap on India? India has burned only 1/20th as much CO2 as we have fossil fuels. They have no reason to accept a low cap. So you have to do it with a carbon fee, and the reason that would work is if China and the United States agree to have a carbon fee, then almost all countries would be coerced to do the same thing because you would put a border duty on products from countries that don't have a carbon fee, and that would be a huge incentive for them to have their own carbon fee so they can collect the money themselves rather than have us collect it at the border. And that's consistent with what Bill Nordhaus calls a climate club. The essential members of the club that you start with are China and the United States.
Do you see any prospects for that actually happening politically? Do you think China might take the lead? The U.S. might take the lead? What do you think might happen?
I think there's a very good chance that China might take the lead because they have a huge incentive, not climate. They do have a big climate incentive, and there are no deniers in the Chinese government. They know climate change is real. They're already feeling, they have a 1.5 standard deviation shift of this bell curve, while the United States is only a half, between a half and one.
But so they're actually feeling climate change.
They're feeling it, and they've got more than 300 million people living near sea level. And the leaders of China are engineer trained. They're trained. They know this is not a hoax that scientists are dreaming up. But they have this air pollution, which is so bad that they have big incentive to phase that down. And they have a hard time doing it. They try to regulate and say, stop this one, stop this emission here and there. But then how do you enforce that? But if you had a rising carbon fee on fossil fuels, it would be a big incentive, which would move things faster toward clean energies.
That was climate scientist James Hansen speaking with Dr. Robert Dubrow, professor of epidemiology and faculty director of Yale University's Climate Change and Health Initiative, during a visit to Yale on April 8th. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Find links to Hansen's latest study and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Six years after the largest oil spill in U.S. history in the Gulf of Mexico, the nation is still trying to assess the long-term economic and environmental destruction. The man-made disaster began on April 20, 2010, after an explosion aboard British Petroleum's Deepwater Horizon oil rig that killed 11 workers and spilled 4.9 million barrels of crude oil into Gulf waters. The spill was even larger than previously calculated, making the disaster the largest marine oil spill in history. Less than 3 weeks before the sixth anniversary of the oil spill, U.S. Judge Carl Barbiere granted final approval to a civil settlement with BP to pay up to $18.7 billion in penalties to the U.S. federal government in five states. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch said in a statement, "Today's action holds BP accountable with the largest environmental penalty of all time, while launching one of the most extensive environmental restoration efforts ever undertaken." Your reporter spoke with Antonia Juhas, an energy analyst, investigative reporter, and author of the book Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Here she explains that the critical hazards of deep-sea offshore oil drilling witnessed in the BP disaster have not changed how the industry or government regulators operate, but has significantly changed public opinion.
It's very clear what caused the disaster, what went wrong, and that much is needed. A radical change is needed. And I think most people would argue that that the change that is needed is to stop offshore oil drilling. But at a minimum, dramatic changes in regulations are certainly required. And the Interior Department has tried to implement new regulations to make offshore drilling more safe, but those attempts have fallen way far short. And most recently, the Interior Department released 500 pages of new regulations less than 2 weeks ago for offshore oil drilling. I interviewed several oil industry experts, including the lead investigator for the U.S. Chemical Safety Board, which is the main federal independent agency that investigates industrial incidents such as this one. It's basically the equivalent of the National Transportation Safety Board that looks at transportation accidents. And their investigators said of these new regulations, they just don't go nearly far enough. And one of the main problems that remains is that even if we have good regulations, the industry is basically given the opportunity to just check off a checklist that says, yes, we do this, yes, we can do that. And then the regulators do not follow up to make sure, one, that the industry can actually do what it says it can do, and then, two, that it is, in fact, doing it. And they cite that failure as pervasive, and that because of that, the chances of another BP-like disasters still remain very present today. Recently, the natural resource damage assessment was completed, and that was a six-year-long process, four federal agencies, over a dozen state agencies, and documents just countless environmental and wildlife harms, including literally, and I'm not exaggerating, trillions of fish species that were killed. It argues or finds that some species such as dolphins could take over 50 years to recover back to where they were when the disaster struck. There was and continues to be a very harmful impact on fisheries and on what is a very big business in the Gulf of Mexico for fisher folk, as they are called, who were harmed and couldn't continue in that business. And what's interesting is that many of those people then turned to the oil sector to find employment because they couldn't work any longer in fisheries. And now the oil sector has collapsed, hundreds of thousands of jobs worldwide being cut from the oil sector, including many cut in the Gulf of Mexico.
Antonio, we only have a few minutes left, but I wanted to reserve a couple of minutes for us to talk about the declining support for offshore oil drilling, both in Louisiana and across the U.S.
I cite a number of polls in my Rolling Stone article, which shows a pretty strong increase in opposition to offshore oil drilling from pre-oil spill to today, from 68% supporting it to 52% supporting it. But I think even more dramatic is a shift in the American public's general view towards how energy should be provided in this country, such that almost 75% of Americans today, the highest percentage since a poll began being taken, support alternative energy, pursuing alternative energy instead of oil and gas development for our energy needs. And most interestingly to me, for the first time, that includes a majority of Republicans.
That was Antonia Juhas, an energy analyst, investigative reporter, and author of the book, Black Tide: The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Find a link to Antonia's recent article, 6 years After the Gulf Oil Spill, Residents Demand No More Drilling, published in Rolling Stone magazine, and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.